Futures up 10, as a futures up 41, and a lot of earnings last night we will talk about. We got to talk to Professor Lou about other stuff, though, first. Lou, how are you?
Good morning, sir.
What's the good word out in Colorado? You guys got no water, I hear.
We're supposed to get, well, let's see. We're supposed to get about 2 feet of snow in the western slope area starting tonight. My place is supposed to get somewhere between 7 and 12 inches of snow. And, I mean, it's going to melt pretty quickly because it's going to get up into the 50s by Saturday. But we're getting a couple of pulses of moisture from the west. Apparently, this is El Nino. You know, it was La Nina pattern for this terrible drought year the last 12 months. We're now moving into an El Nino pattern, which I think, if I read the long-term forecast maps correctly, means that we're either above average or slightly above average for moisture for the next cycle out of the Pacific, which would be wonderful given the how dry it is now. I would take a wet summer here.
The Carl's been kind of on this, and the part of the last, I might say year, the neutral phase between El Nino and La Nina, La Nina was unusually long. That was all last fall and winter.
Yeah.
And then, but now I've read stuff and I haven't heard this from him, but I will ask him. It's like it's moving toward El Nino faster than it ever has before. All of a sudden it broke out of this neutral. It's heading right into El Nino at a rapid pace after being like the longest time ever in neutral. Isn't that weird?
It is. But we don't, we don't have a really good handle on what these climatic cycles look like. We've only been following this for, about the last 60, 70 years?
Yeah.
So I would say that we don't really have much predictive power at this stage. The overall tendency here is drier, tends to be slightly drier, but we're getting plenty of local moisture in spurts like this, in 6 to 8 month spurts. I always point to the ruins down in southwest Colorado and northern and central Arizona, the cliff dwellings at Mesa Verde and Montezuma, the Montezuma National Monument in Arizona, as an indication that none of this is new. The Indian, Native American, whatever civilizations that built those places were living at a time of substantial moisture. And when I say a time of substantial moisture, I mean a couple of hundred years where water flowed through the Southwest in sufficient quantities and with enough regularity that they were able to set up agricultural societies. That's why they were able to build those magnificent structures, is that they were able to grow enough food and to sustain a significant population of builders. And this was, this was all around 800, 900 through about, I think, 1300 AD, 1400 AD. And then it all dried up. We went back to whatever pattern was we see today or was consistent with today's standards. And those civilizations just disappeared, and I mean disappeared.
Well, everybody, everybody's got their own bucket list, I guess. But the drive from Las Vegas to Phoenix, and that's not even I guess you can go further south and west than that. But it's incredible. There's a dry wash every half a mile.
There
had to have been massive amounts of water cascading through those areas and those dry washes at some point.
So I was in northern Arizona maybe 2012 or 2013, and they had they'd had enough rain. It was one of those, you know, make the desert bloom kind of situations. They had had enough rain that the dry rivers in the Navajo reservation were flowing. And there was an actual waterfall there that only is only active, you know, once every 25 or 30 years. And it was active then. There was so much water coming through. And you're right. As you go along, you see remnants of what used to be a very active river culture. Well, I mean, the petrified forest north of or outside of Flagstaff.
Yeah,
you know, that was a subtropical area. The fossil bed monuments outside of Colorado Springs here in Denver or in Colorado are remnants of these gigantic cypress trees that were here. I mean, I think up until about 8 or 9 million years ago, when a volcano came up and wiped everything out. That volcano, by the way, is the reason we have so much gold here in that central part of Colorado. But yeah, so what's happening here and what's happening across the West is the typical boom bust cycle. California, and we've had this discussion, California is criminal in not making plans to retain more of the water that comes in there about every 5 years and basically fills up all the, you know, all the lakes, the reservoirs, and then floods everything. And they just will not. They don't have the political whatever, their political leadership cast will not take steps to retain that water. And so, you know, we get a drought year like this year, and you know, we're on water restrictions already. That's gonna echo down the Colorado River basin all the way to the sea in LA. And we're just gonna have to deal with it. But
it's not just you know, your knee-jerk reaction to a Democratic state. I mean, our late friend Bill Moriarty, who passed last weekend, I'm still can't get over that. But he's in Austin, and he was that just happened to be the last water treatment plant he was involved in putting in, and liked the place and stayed there. He's originally from Chicago, and it's right near where that camp is, where all those kids got killed.
Yeah,
and this is now again. This is a red state, Lou. And he said they had this massive drought over a period of time, and all the reservoirs. He went through a long dissertation, and when they'll replay it, I guess if I can find it. he said these reservoirs were down, and you know, there's desalination supposedly going on, and I think he said in Corpus Christi we're trying to attract some data centers. Well, so far behind schedule, they had to tell the data centers and some contractor who wanted to build 300 houses to leave. So they're in deep doo-doo, and that massive storm hit that killed those kids. He says, first of all, they never should have got the permit. There's kind of the floodplains, and there's floodplains. There's floodplains that are 100-year flood, but the lower dorms were in an area they said there's no way they should have built there. You know, Bill knows this crap. But anyway, he said that storm was so intense that it took the reservoirs from something like 20-30% full to where he was still on the Austin Water Planning Board or whatever it was. He said they were meeting constantly, almost in a panic mode. That storm was so intense, it filled all the reservoirs damn near up to the top. Because all the meetings going forward got canceled.
Yeah.
Okay, we don't have a problem now. We had it before, and I guess we'll look at it next summer or next year.
They don't have the same. Well, two things. First of all, they don't have the agricultural issues, although they may be moving in that direction that Arizona and California and Colorado do, because Texas has been dry long enough that nobody's been out there trying to make that part of the desert bloom. Although, as I said, they may be moving in that direction, and their drought cycles don't at least historically anyway, as I understand it, have not looked like the Southwest, because they're close enough to the Gulf of Mexico, and they're, you know, they border it, that the occasional hurricane comes through, and whatever drought you got, that takes care of it when it moves up into the main body of Texas. The question, the thing that drives me crazy about California is that they've known about this for, you know, for generations, and they took the steps up until the 60s. They were taking the steps that they needed to maintain their water base for their agriculture and their population, and then they stopped.
Well, it comes down to growth. I mean, Phoenix had all kinds of water for 500,000 people, not for 1.5 million.
Right, and Phoenix is, I mean, they're dickering now over what's gonna happen with Lake Powell and Lake Mead and the reservoirs that are falling as the Colorado River Basin goes dry this summer. My note is just that California is in a particular place where they built a structure that was set up to deal with this, with a certain population, and then just failed to keep it up. And B, they're on the ocean. They could get desalinization in place for their cities, at least, and they just refuse to do it, and it's just, that's aggravating.
Well, it's a huge issue. But it comes down to governance at all level. I mean, that's the purpose of economics, Lou. It's how do you apportion scarcity, right? I mean,
in a lot of ways, that's the purpose of government.
Well, yeah, that's what economics does. Who gets to buy what?
So in any event, what I'm hoping for is, since we didn't get our reservoirs filled this winter, we don't have a snowpack. What I'm hoping for is a relatively wet summer that will have enough rain coming through to dampen down the fire danger that is really significant here right now.
Oh yeah,
and I'm hoping the snow will, you know, one of my neighbors calls, you know, when snow comes in, he just says, well, it's free fire insurance.
But so look, these are things that nobody, unless you look at it, nobody, why would you understand it? I mean, you know, Bill came on one day and he goes, you either have two kinds of places in the country. You have surface water and underground water. And I'm going, I didn't know that. I guess if you think it through, you know, some people get their water from underground, some people get it from the surface. Texas gets it from the surface, Nebraska gets it from underground. Because it depends on where you are. I mean, in Chicago, you could actually, matter of fact, I have two books on it because I was fascinated by it. I live here. The history of Chicago is really the history of water management at every level. Drinking, getting rid of it. It's a fat, in Chicago, if you have up to 2 inches of water, of rain, it pretty much is absorbed by the top layer of soil. Underneath that's a clay layer, which doesn't absorb anything. The next 2 inches, 90% of it runs in a river. Now in Arizona or Nevada, the first drop runs, because nothing absorbs into that desert, does it? Everybody thinks the desert is like a sand trap. It's not.
It's excuse me. There's no vegetation to hold it, and so you just,
well,
just
but
runs.
There's no dirt. The desert has like no dirt. It's all crushed rock.
Yeah, the mountains around, or the Front Range here in Denver, is all granite, and the quote soil unquote is powdered granite, and it'll hold some residual mineral value, but it doesn't hold water real well.
Well, you know, it's a situation, but it comes down to. It comes down to population. I mean, in the last 25 years, there was supposed to be the dam on the Platte River, right, outside of Denver. Remember that story?
Yes.
And the you know, and the people on the right, or the people that are not environmentalists, will bitch and moan that it was all about the snake darter or whatever the hell the damn thing was. It had nothing to do with that. It had to do with, okay, let's build a dam for the Platte River. The only problem is the Platte River didn't have any water, right? So the part of the deal was to bust through the mountain and take the water from the Dillon Reservoir, which means the Colorado drainage, and put it in the Platte River drainage, which means we're going to take the money for Denver, or the water for Denver, instead of Phoenix. Really? And that's where, I mean, all these fights are between, really, aren't they, Phoenix suburbs, Vegas suburbs, and Denver suburbs. Am I correct?
L.A. Well, L.A. suburbs. But
well, L.A. doesn't get any water, really, from Hoover Dam.
Yeah, they do. They're part of the... Well, let me put it this way.
Further down, they get the agricultural stuff. They don't get drinking water from there.
They get... Well, whatever. They're part of the... They're part of the Colorado River Pact.
Yes.
That area of California. So they get a vote along with Arizona and, I mean, to a certain extent, New Mexico, and then Colorado and Nevada. So they all get a vote in terms of where, you know, where the water goes and how much can be diverted.
And they can't agree on anything.
No. And notwithstanding the fact that Lake Powell and Lake Mead have been falling through the last 10 years, you would think that these guys would sit down and say, okay, we got to do something here and we got to think this through, and they can't do it.
No.
They I don't, and this is again, I focus on this as a failure of government, because this is exactly what government is supposed to be doing, among other things. They are supposed to be mediating this stuff and mitigating these damages, and they simply can't do it. And some of it's brinkmanship, some of it's one-upmanship, some of it's personality, but it's ludicrous that a resource that is absolutely critical for your populations that are exploding into these areas, you turn a blind eye to the damage that this lack of water is doing to everything: agriculture, development, population, the whole bit. And if you want to see what it looks like when you run out, go down to Cabo San Lucas, or the Los Cabos area of Mexico, on the tip of the Baja, where the Mexican government has basically allowed unrestricted development to go in there in the form of tourist spots, and has essentially allowed those entities to set up and use whatever water they need to bring, you know, bring people in and water their lawns. The rest of the population that supports those places has to get water trucked in, and they have cisterns that give them something like, you know, 2,000 liters for a month. And that's everything. That's all your cooking water, that's your toilet flushing, that's your showers, the whole bit. And they run out. I had an extended conversation with some people the last time I was down there. And just listening to these horror stories of them, you know, measuring the level of their cistern, starting about mid-month to figure out how much they could flush their toilets or how long they could shower. And you know, these are not poverty areas or people in poverty. It's just there is no water for them to live. It's nuts.
It's crazy. I mean, I talk about a wacky family story. I think early 50s, my grandfather, the boilermaker, but bright guy, could read drawings, all those kinds of things. He was going to go out to California and find out if they should move the family to California. So he worked for the railroad, so he hops on the train, he got a ticket for free. All over California for a couple of weeks. He comes back and he goes, his report back to the family was, the population is growing so fast they're going to run out of water. That's why they didn't move. This is the 50s. This is my grandfather. the population's growing faster than their ability to keep up with the water supply. How's that for a 70-year-ago assessment? I mean, because when did Mulholland do all this stuff in the 30s, right?
Yep. Yeah, no, they that we've talked about this before. That water project in California is a masterpiece of hydro engineering.
For X and number of million people. And now they get X plus.
Yeah, X times 10.
Yeah.
And we're seeing the same thing here in Denver. And I've talked about the client that I had who figured out a way to extract and purify water coming out of the mines, the abandoned mines that are up in the mountains outside of Breckenridge. There's I think 200 and some odd miles of mining tunnel through the through these mountains, and this acts as a giant trap for snowfall and snowpack that melts and would go into runoff, but in any event, it collects in these mine shafts, and it's contaminated with heavy metals because that's why they were mining there, is because they could reach gold, copper, tin, lead, but the water collects this stuff. It's contaminated and it's not usable. He figured out a way to decontaminate it, to remove the minerals and purify it sufficient for potability. And so he set up a system whereby he's pumping, I think it's 200,000 or 300,000 acre feet of water a year out of these things and dumping it into the Dillon Reservoir, where it's added. Yeah, it's added to the drinking water store. Now, water is fungible, so that water that goes into that reservoir is purchased. It raises the level of the reservoir, but it's purchased by the suburbs of Denver. Something else that's interesting that's going on right now. Denver maintains a couple of major reservoirs in the central part of the state. One of them is called the Antero Reservoir, bigger Lake Antero. It's a dam, built during the Depression, and it's near Mount Antero. It's pretty close to being almost in dead center of the state, but it's a big shallow reservoir, and so Denver is aware. The water management people are aware that the evaporation off of that reservoir is much higher than it is off the other reservoirs that they've got that are a lot deeper and narrower, and so they are draining that reservoir. Now it's a huge recreational site for boating and fishing. And they're trying to collect as many of the fish as they can and dump them into some of the other reservoirs. But they are going to drain that reservoir down to mud.
They're going to take the boaters and dump them in the other reservoir too.
They're telling the boaters, you're not going to be able to boat here. Move your boats.
What's a little reservoir just south of Breckenridge? There's a little one there. We went out there one summer. And my buddy's a big fisher dude.
Yep.
So we get down there and he's fishing. Of course, he can catch crap. But I look at it going, where's the water coming for this thing? And sure enough, I walk around to the side. There's this hole. You're right up on the divide. You're way up there. So they poke the hole through the divide. They were taking water from the other side, pumping it through to the Platte River side.
Yep. They have the ability. It's a very smart system. I don't know if we could build it now, but it's a very smart system. But they're going to drain this reservoir down to mud. Because the evaporation...
What are you going to do with it?
The water?
No, the reservoir. Let it sit there, hole?
It sits there. Yeah, it sits there until we get enough rain to justify filling it back up again.
Hey, real quick, there's a bunch of stuff we need to talk about. I'm sure you have a list, but what do you do in a situation where we're talking about these guys can't come to an agreement? I'll keep my version of this. Nobody cares what happened to me, but I was chairman of this committee at the CBOE. I was chairman of the DPM committee, Lou. And the only reason why I was chairman is because I had a reputation as being a pretty honest guy. And I also knew that I was in the OEX pit, which had nothing to do with the DPMs. So I was essentially, they knew I had no skin in the game. So for one person's view, I was the perfect chairman. For my view is, what am I doing here? argue with these people at stuff that I don't even really... Well, actually, I did care about it, but there was an issue that when the DPMs, which is a specialist, were essentially created, they said for running the book, or running the whole thing, the DPM was going to get a pro rata... could demand a pro rata share of every trade. So if somebody came in and bought 100 lot and there were 10 guys and they didn't hear it, they could demand 10 of them, by my definition, by anybody's. Well, from day one, they define pro rata as they get the first 50%, even if they didn't hear it. So this went on and on and became a big fight, big fight. And all of a sudden, it lands in this committee, and I'm the chairman. And Lou, I had probably six people on one side of the table that were associated with DPMs, and six people on the other side that were dead center, these guys stealing 50% of something when they're supposed to get 10, 20, or 30, whatever. And you know what, Lou? What's the point of even having a meeting? I mean, there's no way that the California governor sends the California guy to the meeting and says, if you think it makes sense, you can back us off a little bit. It's never going to happen. I mean, what's the point of even going there?
I don't. And this is what, as I said, this is what drives me crazy. And this, frankly, this is what you have lawyers for. And I I think a lot of this, Tom, goes the way a lot of my litigation goes, where you literally have to get people in a position where they are about to lose a substantial amount of money, or they're about to have some horrible thing happen, and they go right to the brink, and everybody does this. And the fact that you could have reached a much more economically intelligent arrangement 6 months ago, before you spent all this money on lawyers and litigation costs, you could have gotten to this point without having to spend all that money and economically been a lot smarter. But they don't want to do that, because I think there's just this idea that I'm going to lose some advantage. And so, yeah. And so what should have happened early on, which is everybody's in a room and they are basically saying to themselves, we have to make it a deal now. Everybody's in a room, you sit down, and over the course of 8 or 10 or 12 hours, I mean, or days, I've had settlement discussions that have taken days, you hammer out some type of compromise arrangement. And nobody wants to do it, and everybody's angry and short-tempered, and everybody walks out of it thinking, you know, we got screwed. But that's basically what it takes. And I don't understand why our business models are set to this. If everybody had, I mean,
Luke, because we're talking about, you read enough Greek tragedies. People haven't changed.
Agreed. But so we have a case. I have a case where we've got a, you know, a bunch of claims about discrimination and how this business was being run, and so a lawsuit gets filed, and the company has insurance, but they've only got insurance for, say, $100,000. Now, that will cover maybe half of what the litigation cost will be, just for that side. And if the client loses, if the guy with insurance loses the case, he not only has to pay his attorney fees, he has to pay the other side's attorney fees.
And you guys charge too much.
So, well, I mean, I'm pretty reasonable on this situation because there's insurance involved. But he's the short answer is he's looking at a policy that will not cover the risk or the exposure that he's got, and that he could be doubled if he loses the case. So we sit him down and we're talking to the other side, and we can at this early stage, before anybody sits down at deposition or before we get the other side's documents or before anything that happens, we can get rid of the case for a number that is within the insurance amount. The other side tells us this. They said, yeah, we'll take X at this stage without having to incur all these other expenses. And the people on the client side don't want to do it. No, this is outrageous, and you know, we didn't do anything wrong, and we're not, you know, millions for defense and not one penny for tribute. And we have to sit them down and say, you are facing your business, which is a small business. Your business is facing an existential risk. If this litigation goes forward, you will burn through this insurance amount that you've got before you even get to a courtroom, months before you get to a courtroom. And then you're going to have to start paying it out of your own pocket. Not only that, there is a risk. I can't tell you how much it is right now because I don't know exactly what the other side's got in terms of evidence, but there is a risk. Let's say it's somewhere between 30 and 50% that you could lose. And if you lose, all of this financial risk that you've agreed to take on here is doubled in terms of the cost.
I think,
but you can get rid of this right now.
For
nothing, effectively.
Real quick, I just want to interject something about people. And at a base layer, Dr. J's wife, Bridget McGrath, terrific lady, just retired from being a judge a while ago. For a while, she was in divorce court. And she said, it's amazing. One night we were having dinner and a couple of adult beverages. And she says, you know, I'm starting to do the math. See, it seems like at every level, you know, couples that don't have a lot of money, couples that have a real lot of money, they essentially piss through 40% of their stuff fighting, and then they decide to talk, even if they hate each other. There's like a number you run into. And what you're talking about with your stuff, Lou, I would never debate you on your individual case. But what I've seen here, especially in the arbitration areas, there's a couple of groups of attorneys that just lob stuff at people.
Yep.
And then the big firms, the first thing they say, they call their attorney and they go, how much is this going to cost to defend? Oh, $100,000. All right, well, will they take 50? Yeah. All it does is encourage the biggest sleazebags on earth.
It does. And that's an issue. But in a situation where you've taken out the insurance policy and you're fully insured, this is a different calculation. This is one where I might tell the client, look, fight this. You know, you're from an economic perspective, this makes sense to fight it. And you know who Bill Ackman is?
Yep.
Okay. So he
He's been on the news lately. He wants to do some stuff.
Pardon me?
He's been on the news lately again.
Well, yeah. And he just wrote an extensive Twitter article. He's being sued there's a claim against him by somebody that was running his family trust or something like that. And he's very, very straightforward with it. He said, you know, this person has done this. She's claiming this. She's claiming some kind of, you know, gender discrimination. There's nothing there. But I'm being told to settle because it's going to cost X amount to defend it. And he said, and all I'm doing is reinforcing bad behavior.
Yep.
If I do that.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to fight it. And I'm going to force her to prove her case. I'm going to force her to go through. I'm going to make the judicial system work. And that's a real issue.
Yeah, but he's got the money.
He's got the money to do it, and he can afford to do it. One of the effects of the explosion of litigation that we have that results from you know, I think from too many laws and too many regulations that provide legal means for people to, you know, to go after their employers, other companies, whatever. But this explosion that slows down legal processing means that, for example, in Colorado, in federal court, a lawsuit that gets filed will take 4 years before you get a trial result.
It's five here.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And what that does is that's all opportunity cost. You know, and somebody said at one point, in with respect to what was happening to, well, first to the Trump people and now to Comey and some of these guys, the process, that 4 or 5 year process, that's the punishment.
Yep.
Having to have this over your head, having to have a constant run of expenses and a constant outflow of
money. No individual can possibly fight the government with money out of their own pocket, unless you're
well, Ackman. or fight somebody who you know. If you're an aggressive plaintiff's law firm, fight an aggressive plaintiff's law firm that makes this its business.
Well, I mean, you've got to. We're not talking about the president. This is long before he was a president. That was his modus operandi.
That was part of what he did. Yep. He had law firms that would do that.
And it's, you know, it's some, you know, what you're talking about, the system not working. It comes down to this guy in Chicago that shot the policeman and killed him last weekend. You know, horrible story.
At the hospital. Yeah. And, it's Swedish.
Yeah. And the guy runs out of the place naked with the what do you call it? The electrocardiogram thing still on his chest, running through the neighborhood. Man, you couldn't write fiction like this. But anyway, the guy's got all this huge, you know, list of things he did bad.
How did he did they ever figure out how he got the gun?
Lou, I gave an opinion I never should have the other day on the air. I don't know if I want to do it again. I wonder if he snagged one of those guys' drop gun.
Hmm.
They've been very quiet on where he got the gun. It's never been said that he used the officer's service revolver, that there was this mysterious other gun. Yet the guy's, naked. The guy's naked.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. He's not concealing it. I just assumed he grabbed a gun from one of the officers.
But it doesn't seem to have been their service revolver. At least that's not been said. It could have been. But nobody has admitted that he took. That the guy who got shot and killed, it was like his service revolver. It's not. It's very weird the news coming out on this. Whatever it is, I mean, the poor guy's dead. And he was a good guy. I mean, for God's sake, and the other guy's wounded pretty bad. But what you're talking about, the problems in the justice system. Now, this guy shouldn't have been on the street, okay? But you also have a situation where it's not 4 years, but it's a year and a half before these guys go to trial.
Yeah.
And a significant percentage of them are found not guilty. I have cocktails with attorneys that do this. I get once a week or twice, a couple times a month. And over a year and a half, the police can be very sloppy in the arrest. The witnesses either are gotten to by that point or forget or move or something. If you don't have DNA or you don't have video, you know, some huge percentage of these guys get off. Well, if that's the case, you can't keep somebody in jail for a year and a half only to be let out, only to be found not guilty. That's not right either. I mean, I there's so much wrong at every level, Lou, just like you're talking about on this other stuff. There's so much wrong at every level. How do you even start to fix it? It's so screwed up. I mean, I don't know how you force a trial at the time. What they have started to do here is evidently they're taping the witnesses during the grand jury. So if the story completely changes in court, at least they can play the tape of during the grand jury. I don't know what that does, but it you know, at least if the lawyer says, gee, you fingered the guy 18 months ago and now you're saying you never met him, well, here's what you said back then. I don't know what that does to you as a lawyer, but at least they're saving that testimony. I don't know what does that even mean? You're an attorney, not me, but it's not really admissible.
It's admissible, but it's not admissible to establish. Typically, it's not admissible to establish guilt or innocence. Or guilt. I guess we don't have to prove innocence. So you would offer that if the guy gets up and says, I saw Y shoot the victim, and he says that at the grand jury, and then at the trial he says I saw X shoot the victim. they can put the previous testimony up and play it to show that he's a liar.
Yeah.
Okay. He's a liar. Either he lied first when he said he saw Y shoot the victim, or he's a liar now when he says X. And but you can't argue that the previous statement, I saw Y shoot the guy, is evidence that Y actually did the shooting. And so you got to have other evidence to prove that. And what you do, the way you deal with this, I've had this happen. I was a criminal prosecutor and defense lawyer when I first started practicing law. What you do is you put that statement in, I saw Y shoot him, the previous statement in front of the grand jury, and then you hope that the other evidence that you have that Y was the killer is enough to sway the jury to vote for the conviction. But what you're also doing is trying to, in an indirect way, influence the jury so that they will think to themselves, because you can't argue this, but they will think to themselves, that guy changed his story. He's lying when he tells us now that it was X that shot the victim. When he said Y shot him in front of the grand jury, it's Y that did the shooting. And you can't argue that, but you're hoping that the jury picks up on that.
Okay.
But that's how it comes in.
Well, what, real quick on this tariff situation. I heard early on, all right, the Supreme Court says the tariffs were not proper. By the way, I agree with that 100%. I think I knew that going into it, but anyway. but they do collect all this money.
It was actually a closer. If you listen to the argument, I thought when I first read the lawsuits, I thought this is going to be a slam dunk. He doesn't have the authority. But if you heard the oral arguments at the Supreme Court, it was actually a lot closer than I thought.
Well, whatever.
Less like the birthright citizenship. Anyway,
but
he lost.
But what I'm saying, it's not. At that level, it's absolutely a tax. You don't put a tariff on the whole world and say it's an emergency situation from every single country. I mean,
right,
especially
right.
If like Luxembourg is a country, and like, where's Luxembourg? Where's the
I know where Luxembourg is.
Well,
pick something more obscure. Pick Andorra.
You know what we import from Luxembourg?
What, chocolate?
No, false teeth.
Oh, okay.
Evidently, the world's best man. Whatever, but as soon as it happened, Lou, some people on the show will because I don't agree with them. I got to be some flaming liberal, but I'm not. I'm kind of in the middle. The first I heard of this, I go, you know what? I didn't agree with them. I'm glad the Supreme Court ruled the way they did, but let the dead dog lie. Don't try and give it back to people, because it'll never get back to the people where it belongs. So just, and I read at the time, of course you read this stuff, people know what the hell they're talking about. I read at the time that Congress could pass a bill that said, look, we agree with, I don't think they had to agree with anything, just said, whatever we've collected so far, we're just going to keep.
Yeah.
And I was firmly behind that, because guess what, Lou, they didn't call me and ask. And now I'm seeing this money go back to people. And General Motors evidently, what is it, I don't know, $5 billion or $500 million or something, $500 million they're supposed to be getting back. And what about you that went out and bought a new car? You're not going to get a friggin' dime? What is wrong with us? What is wrong with us? We're going to give the money to General Motors and that say, okay, everybody bought a car from you in the last year, you got to send them a $1,000 check? We're not going to make them do that. Is there something wrong with us?
Well, it seems to me if you're going to make that collection, you need to work it all the way back. And I don't know enough. I haven't read that story, but I don't know enough about.
Well, Walmart's supposed to get a trillion too.
about the process, no, but it would seem...
Yeah,
it would,
Walmart's going to get $1 trillion. Not a trillion. How much they collect total on us? But there's a massive amount of dough. Nike's going to get a bunch. Walmart's by far the biggest beneficiary. Then
so,
Home Depot,
so yeah,
and a couple of...
Because Walmart stuff all comes from China. So...
Well, Home Depot's come from Canada, and...
Yeah,
the lumber's
so,
out.
So doesn't... I mean, those transactions can be tracked.
Well, I mean, you know, Carl, he's not an attorney, but he's pretty bright. He goes, an individual has no status. The people who paid it was General Motors. They paid
that's
it.
True.
He goes, so if you have no status, you can't prove that they didn't. As far as General Motors is going to say, oh no, we absorbed it all.
Yeah, General Motors would say we didn't pass it along.
Yeah, which
they didn't run
BS.
Long enough for us to pass it along.
Yeah, with total BS, obviously.
I don't know.
Well, Walmart.
I mean, we didn't.
You
we
think
didn't
Home,
suffer.
You think Home Depot? None of the raise in lumber price at their place was due to the tariff.
We didn't. We didn't see that giant jump in inflation that was supposed to happen when those things went into effect. So I don't know if they passed it along.
Lou, don't right? don't take this as insulting. If you don't, if you look at the CPI, you didn't see it. If you go to Home Depot, you see it.
Well, okay. So we know prices went up. So we're at the point, I suspect, where we have the same issue that we have with concussions. Where's the causality? Is the causality the result of the money supply issue that you railed against, that you and I railed against for a decade? Is it the result of these tariffs? And what, you know, where do you break it out? I'm gonna say that unless you can make a showing. Carl's right on this. Unless you can make a showing that there was a price increase tied directly to the tariff and a dollar for dollar increase in terms of the prices you were paying, I would say you probably don't get a shot at recovery.
And I think he's right, but I also know that you and I, Lou, we've been around a while, bud. If General Motors claims that they paid, pick a number, $500 million to the government, and last year cars went up $3,000. Boy, it's starting to smell, doesn't it? That there's a connection there.
Well, they're right, and I'm sure there is a connection, but you gotta define it, and it's got to be refined down to a number.
Well, I think that when you go, it's a lot easier. If I was going to, you know, take a shot at this, it's a lot easier to follow a 2x4 from Canada to Home Depot than it is to the 1,000 parts that are in a car, right? I mean, if the day the 2x4 got a 50-cent tariff on it, a month later, looks like Home Depot raised the price of 2x4, it's probably a buck, not 50 cents. I guess it's still not causality, but sure as hell it's coincidence, isn't it?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's as I said, I'm sure there's some causation now or some causation element there, but for relief you have to prove it. You have to be able to draw a relatively straight line from one to the other, and you have to be able to quantify it. And that was, as I said, it's the old concussion,
well, it's
NFL,
the, you know,
concussion
the,
problem
the thing that I'm you know, I'm sure as hell not going to try and explain it now, but the thing I can't ever really get through to anybody, Lou, being pretty much anybody, is that there's a huge difference between an oil price shock where the price of gas goes up and a general inflation shock caused by too much money in the system. Because one causes one thing to go up to the extent that people cut back there, they do, but if they can't, they have to spend more on it. If it's a necessary good, it leaves them less in other places where they're going to spend less in other places. So you could certainly do the math and say, all right, I'm gonna, my cost of gas is $20 more this week. Therefore, I'm going to go out and have a beer three nights instead of four. This it comes back on the bar. So you can work that through the system. It's not the same as the Fed putting 30% more money into the system, where some stuff, the gas is still going to be up 60%. But by the way, the beer is going to be up 20%, even though they're selling less of it. There's a difference between general inflation level and individual cost spikes. That is essentially the beauty of our economy, Lou, is some stuff goes up if it's competitive, and all of a sudden you see the price of nails go up to whatever at Home Depot, somebody in America is going to go, I'm going to sell nails online. Screw this Home Depot. That's a vibrant economy. That's what our economy is based on. That's the beauty of us, even though most people don't even know that that's what it is now. That's the beauty of us. We can do stuff like that. Where in Russia, you couldn't. Here, it's getting harder and harder. But in those kinds of spikes, you know, if all of a sudden gas triples, well, somebody's going to find a way to run a car on natural gas. That's our system. But it's not the same as the Fed doubling the money supply where everything just doubles. It's just a different...
I agree. The mechanism is different, yeah. but at the bottom line, at the pocketbook level, you have to be able to refine out how much of this right. is one thing and how much of this is another.
Let me give you one quick example, and then let's want to talk a lot about the bring me one more topic. But if you go back in monetary history, one of the biggest advancements in terms of technology and in terms of everything was right after the Civil War, when people had nothing, and it wouldn't look like an advance in technology now, but it was to them. You know, your metallurgy was better because of all the stuff they learned about metals, and your plows were better. Everything was better, right? And you had places like Sears coming in where you actually get stuff at home. Well, the money supply, it actually was a deflationary period because... The union.
Well, I remember this. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a deflationary period because the Fed, well, there wasn't a Federal Reserve, but whoever was in charge must have been the Treasury. They actually dragged money out of the system to go back on the gold standard. They went out and, I don't know how they did it, but they essentially pulled all the greenbacks out of the system. So the money supply went down. Prices went down, but things were still very vibrant. So just because, like, now today, this administration, like the four or five before them, it's incredibly difficult to determine how good things are, because on the gross numbers, that we're doing fine. Yeah, General Motors sold $90 billion worth of cars last year. Okay, wait a minute. How much were the price of the cars? Did they actually sell less cars? I mean, nobody digs down on that anymore. So the question is, are we doing better or aren't we? What about the average person now who can't afford stuff? We went from the unemployed to the unemployed poor to the working poor. I don't know if that's a good thing. There's a place here, and Louis, I apologize for it. I can't remember the name of the union, but somebody is now authorized to strike. It's a big group here. I don't know if it's the hospital workers. It's somebody. The offer on the table for them is a 14% increase. Now, I don't know how long they've been fighting about this. 14% increase in wages over the next 3 years. Lou, who the hell could... What kind of deal is that for anybody? I mean, what has inflation been in the last 5 years? 40%? How the hell can somebody put something like that together? One last week, these guys signed up for a deal where they're using the CPI as the escalator.
Yeah.
God bless it. What manner of moron would use a CPI?
Yeah, well, I get it, but again, having been in those negotiations, I understand.
But it's better than nothing. It's better than no escalation. Yeah. I get that, but not much.
Yeah.
What, Lee, the question I would ask, I mean, if I was, God, boy, they'd throw me out of a meeting in a second with Chairman Powell yesterday. Plus, I want your comment on why he's not leaving. But if I were to ask, if ever anybody's arguing with you about inflation and the CPI, sometimes, Lou, I get this style. It's probably not a good style. But you like to ask the question back. And if I would say, if Chief and Lou and Jim Lawler, our producer today, got in a business where we were building 10 houses a year for somebody 10 years ago, and say the price of the house was, whatever, $300,000, and we built it for $270 or $260, and we're going to make $40,000 on it, and that's good enough, and we put a CPI escalator in it. Lou, are we in business? I'm thinking no.
I've had union contracts with CPI escalators. And generally the company thinks that's both the company and the union think that's a reasonable measure of cost.
Well, it used to be. I'm talking about the last 5 or 6 years. Are we still in our house building business? I think we're broke.
Let's just say I would I would expect to see negotiations reopened.
I love it.
How's that?
Hey, from your conversation earlier, is the snow you get this time of the year have a higher water content? I've been in Steamboat when I got a foot and a half in the dead of January, and God, you can shovel it with one finger. I mean, there's no water.
This will have a slightly higher water content than normal. So not that much. It'll it varies dramatically by where you are and what altitude the snow is falling at. But it typically, this will probably be a little bit more than an inch per 10 inches of snow.
Okay, because I mean, some of the stuff in the wintertime is like, is there any water in it?
It's like 0.7.
Yeah.
Per 10 inches. But
that's where you get the big trail behind you and the powder, and the guys with the beards have all the, you know, you break the beard up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not going to be that kind of snow. It'll be a heavier snow because it's falling at a warmer temperature.
Well, next week let's talk a little bit about the draft. I'm not big on drafts because it's not my economic stuff. But how is it that the football? And I'm almost willing to roll with this, Luke, because they only have 7 rounds. How does baseball get away with 30 rounds, for God's sake? That's like 900 people. They can't get a job somewhere else.
They carry, well, because of their farm system, they can theoretically carry up this gigantic roster. You know, the NFL roster is 53 plus however many they've got on the practice squad. So the baseball can carry a lot more. And, you know, it's a matter of how much they tolerate. You know, the NFL guys are in my personal opinion, is the NFL people are just more impatient. You know, well, I mean, let's get this over with.
If you're a 7th round draft pick, are you better off being drafted or being able to pick a team that maybe needs you? I mean, if you were a 10th round pick, I really believe that if you're a 25th round in baseball, you're better off finding a team that needs you.
Yeah. It's very player specific, because I've represented a number of undrafted free agents who were right at the cusp of getting signed, and generally it's better to be drafted because that sends a signal to other programs that somebody thought you were worth a lot, and it puts you in the top two, whatever it is, 260, 270 guys. I think it's probably better, but from a financial perspective, especially the guys in the latter half of the 7th round, it's not that much difference.
Well, if you're a down lineman on defense in the 7th round, you go to a team that runs a 3-4. Aren't you better off finding somebody that has a 4-3?
Sometimes, but it depends on the people around you.
Okay,
I've told guys that, you know, we don't want to go to that. You know, this team's talking to you, but we don't want to go there unless we have to, because they don't have a supporting cast for your particular style of play. You know,
well, that's this, this, I think we got
it, it, it's more this, prevalent. It's more prevalent in offense than it is on defense.
Do you think that quarterback that went number one is that good?
That good?
Well, I mean, I don't see him being an Elway or a Manning. I really don't.
No, I don't think he's there yet. Do I think he could be a Brock Purdy? Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the guy, the number one in the draft. Brock Purdy was the last guy in the draft.
Yeah, but Brock Purdy was an incredibly, a very successful NFL quarterback.
Right.
But he's not a Hall of Fame guy, but I think he's a very successful NFL quarterback. I think this kid could function in an offense like that. I don't think he's the guy. I don't think he's a Brett Favre type, where you can put the offense on his back. At least not yet.
What do you think happened with this Las Vegas pick? Or even the coach doesn't like the guy, supposedly. The quarterback.
Vegas or the Rams? You're talking about the Rams.
Rams,
the quarterback. I think the GM overrode everybody else and the owner.
Doesn't he know the guy's father or something?
Is that the rumor? They did. There was a relationship there, yeah. But I think the GM and the owner just overrode everybody.
Well,
that happens.
If you really wanted a guy, why don't you just trade down and get him later?
because they wanted, the GM wanted him.
Really?
And that's all it takes.
I think the Bears did good, but I get the weird feeling that safety was the strong part of their team 2 years ago. They kind of just, and so was the center this year till the guy quit, and all of a sudden they're kind of right back where they started from. You know, I mean, I think they're a couple of really good picks, but they're kind of spots that were good to start with, and they're just gone.
Well, for the offensive line, you can always move that guy.
That's probably true. All right, bud, take care of yourself, and stay out of the blizzard.
Yeah, I'm actually going up into the middle of it tonight, so keep your fingers crossed. Oh, we'll talk to you next week.
All right, Jimmy, we got our guys?
Yes, we do.
Our guys, hey, how are you?
Just fine. I'm still trying to get my head wrapped around the fact that King Charlie III was course-correcting us on constitutional governance.
Well, all the guy has to do is be able to read, which I think he can, and realize we're kind of off the rails here. Hey, does that mean his cancer is in remission? They had him down for the count a few months ago. Is he doing better?
Yeah, you know, there was a close-up photo taken at one of the White House events where King Charles's hands looked as bad as Trump's. And I maybe for different reasons, but red and blotchy. So I'm sure he's traveling with his personal physician. But it seems like, yeah, his cancer may be in some sort of remission.
You think he's getting chemo weekly, or are they done with that, or is in a?
Yeah, they may be done with that. And he, although he doesn't have a hectic schedule, Washington D.C., New York, and some event in Virginia, he seems to be able to get around pretty well.
Still got his hair.
Yeah. Well.
I mean,
he still has some.
Well, I mean, but I'm saying, a lot of times chemo just destroys that.
Oh yeah, right.
What the? Andrew, how are you?
Good. I enjoyed the earlier discussion and raring to go here.
What the? Are you going to start going back to the Comey trials? You thought you were done with that.
Well, these are going to be in North Carolina. It'll never get to a trial. It'll be hearings. But each day, there's a whole variety of courtroom and hearing choices, and so you got to pick what's near you. But then you got to think, well, what are you actually going to see that's useful? So what was this? I was actually talking to Wayne about something, some big hearing. Oh, the supposed shooter from the White House Correspondents' Center. That first hearing was Monday, and I went over to the courthouse on that. And I was chatting with Wayne while I was walking over, and we were kind of laughing. Well, what's really going to be accomplished by being in the courtroom as opposed to reading about it later and getting a sense of it. So these are the choices your on-the-ground reporter makes on a daily basis.
Well, that is the truth. That's a hell of a long train ride. If he was in coach, he must have smelled pretty gamey by the time he got to Washington.
Well, he supposedly checked into the what I and many others have come to call the Hinckley Hilton, because that's where Reagan had been shot.
Really?
Okay. Talk about poor choice of words. When Caroline Leavitt said that there's going to be shots fired tonight, this is when she was on the on the rope line at the red carpet thing there. She was mere steps away from where one of her predecessors, Jim Brady, was shot by Hinckley and left in a vegetative state for the rest of his life. So I just, this isn't even the D team in the White House. This is a collection of fools at best.
Well, I listened to Hegseth in front of Congress yesterday. It was pretty bad.
I remember going to college with guys like that, and I hated them then, and I with Hegseth, I think I hate them more now.
It's guys that are, I don't know, they're born on third and thought they hit a triple or something. I don't know. It's a. but you know there are definitely are people like that. But they were hitting them up pretty good. This whole idea. Did you see the? I played there once. God, it was nothing but sand. And it was hotter than hell. I played at the Doral years ago. But you know what was fascinating about the Doral when I was talking about walking off the theme here. This had to be 1998-ish, my last year on the board. It's right by the runway of Miami Airport, and I saw so many old planes. That I saw 707s coming in there with mustaches on it. I saw DC-3s landing. God, you could never see that at O'Hare. The only place the only two airports they can still land that stuff.
You were next to the CIA apron there at Miami International with all those old planes coming in and out unmarked.
Maybe, yeah. I hadn't seen a 707 in 20 years, and a couple of those came in. What is that, a 707? And there were a whole bunch of 727s when they were retiring them everywhere else. But the DC-3s, I had never seen one of those things land before. They land, they come in with the nose down. They're weird. Well, they're weird compared to a jet.
But when I was stationed in Barbados in the Navy, I arrived on island in one of those DC-3s. I mean, it's, you get onto the plane from the back and have to walk up like a steep ramp. The aisle, it's at an angle. And, talk about there were people bringing, bananas and mangoes that were in passengers, taking them from one island to another.
Well, that thing's not pressurized or air conditioned, is it?
Oh, no.
No, it's a...
No, it's...
God. Andrew, did you see the new statue down at the Doral?
No, I didn't.
Well, this is the first tournament that the Rails had in like 10 years. It's a terrific course, when you get in your cart, they give you a rake for the sand traps. that's how many you're going to be in, right? There's like a 15-foot high statue of Trump right next to the first tee now. It's in gold. All the players walked out and look at that, and they go, "What the hell is that?" I guess it just went up like last week. Some guy in Ohio made it. And then he was behind schedule, and he trucked it down there and put it. Is it 30 tons or 3 tons? Is this huge monstrosity statue of Trump all in gold? It's now right off the first tee.
I can only think all of this, these monuments didn't help the pharaohs in Egypt or Goldfinger in the movie.
Are you guys hustling over today to get your passport with Trump's picture on it?
The first thing I did when I heard that, I went and found my passport, and I couldn't remember when I renewed it, but it was not that long ago, so it's good till 2033. So hopefully he'll be long gone then.
Mine's only good for like another year or two. I really don't want one with his picture on it.
No. not one country now or ever has put their leader, whether it's a king, emperor, president, prime minister, whatever, on their passport. This is
not even Papa Doc.
Not even Papa Doc. Not Idi Amin. Not Mao Zedong. None of them. This is an absolute first. I just read an article that he doesn't want to go down in history as one of the best presidents. He wants to go down in history as one of the all-time leaders of modern history. He wants to be another Napoleon and Julius Caesar. And he meant, apparently, whoever reported this said he mentioned that by those two by name.
They're kind of different. Julius Caesar used to be at the front end of the army. I don't think Trump ever wants to do that.
Yeah. And
hey, I got a question for a Navy guy. If you'd give me a second here, the aircraft carrier. I asked Hal the other day because he was on a cruiser, but or a frigate of some kind. When those guys put into that Greek port to fix the fire damage for like a month or two, where does everybody go? There's 5,000 people, and there's 5,000. They must fly the air wing off the thing.
Yeah, and they probably one of the other air bases in Sicily or maybe in Germany. But the crew stays on board. Now I see that the Ford is now returning to the States.
It is? Okay.
After 10-month deployment, which is, you know, real long for a ship like that. And it'll be interesting to see where it pulls into. If it pulls into one of the shipyards, that I think is an indication that was much worse than a laundry fire on board.
Well, so they kicked the Ike out early, and they've got the original one. The Nimitz is out again for its last cruise too. So they kicked the Ike. They kicked the Eisenhower. I'm sorry, the Eisenhower went out on record time, right?
Yeah,
because that was a total refit. I mean, for those who don't know what we're talking about, when an aircraft carrier, there actually was a terrific. Andrew, I bet you remember this. I still have it at home somewhere buried. It's a Time magazine article where a guy went out on an aircraft carrier deployment. He was kind of off and on, but at the time, we, the U.S. of A., wanted four aircraft carriers out at all times. One in the Atlantic, one in the Pacific, one in the Indian Ocean, and one in the Mediterranean. Isn't that the way it was, guys? So if you're out for 6 months, when you come back, even if the ship's like was brand new, it's busted up. It takes all those guys pretty much go home. You know, most of them, their tour is over. The lifers hang there. All the contractors descend on the place. All the catapults got to be like redone. All the elevators. You name it. I mean, it's wore out. And it takes like 6 months for this to happen. Meanwhile, you're getting a whole new crew. Then you've got another 6 months of sea trials and shaking out and all that stuff. And basically, if you want four carriers out all the time, you need 16 of them. And that's the math. So if you decide you want to go from 16 to 12, well, now people better be out there 8 months, which is a real stretch. Because this stuff is, you know, even though the hangar's going up how many times a day, to say 6 months it's kind of shot, you can do some repairs at sea, but basically it's shot. And so what we're doing now, we got less of them. We only got like 10 of them, right? And now we want like five of them out there. How does that math work?
Yeah, you see these extended tours. You're right about, seawater takes a toll on every ship. That's why in the old, when I first came in the Navy, went on to, I think I was at the Norfolk Navy shipyard, I saw more guys, bosun mates, hanging over the side, just chipping away and painting, because of the rust factor from seawater. It does a number not only on the hull, but on all, as you mentioned, the elevators and whatnot, all the moving equipment. I mean, seawater and anything made out of metal do not mix well.
Well, Hal was saying that and he was out there for an extended period. How long they were? Not in the Persian. It might have been the Gulf, but he said it was. You know, he never went in 30 days. He never got topside, and the water was like 90 degrees or something. You know, he said it was just brutal.
Yeah.
And one of the air conditioners was out. He said, but after a period of time, because everybody, you know, you work for your 8 or 10 hour shift, you got like 4 hours where you're supposed to do maintenance. He said, well, after a certain amount of time, you can't keep up with the maintenance, so they start slashing things off the list. You know, we're not going to paint that thing. We're going to leave that till next week or the week after. He said, when you finally limp back, it doesn't look like when you limped out.
Well, here's, as a members of the media, all of us, let me redirect, if you don't mind, for a moment, the conversation to how do we know about this stuff? And let's look at what's just happened in terms of the media covering what's going on. So, big picture, you have the Secretary of War or Defense. It makes basically all of the reporters take a loyalty oath or they're kicked out of the Pentagon. And since none of them virtually would do it, except for a few fringe...
Andrew, didn't the Supreme Court just rule against that?
Yeah, but they, in their usual modern way, they didn't make it enforceable. I don't think it was the Supreme Court. It might have been a court of appeals.
Okay.
But they kind of made a general ruling, but what the implementation of it is kind of left to the very parties that are at issue. And so the Pentagon has basically made it extremely difficult for anybody to cover the Pentagon these days. And the second and final thing I wanted to mention was Stars and Stripes is the service publication that kind of lives in a partly created by the government, but partly with an independent tradition. And just in the last few days, they fired the ombudsman, who Wayne and I actually knew. Her name is Jacqueline Smith. And they thought, well, this is government-funded, so we're not going to have even a semblance of independence here to report on the military.
I mean, you know, why do people not understand how bad this is? Didn't they just bleep can the National Science Group, too, yesterday, the day before?
Oh, yeah, the National Science Foundation. well, I think with Trump, anything he thinks he owns, everything that is in the federal government or even is not even in the federal government, if it's got U.S. or national or anything federal in its name, he thinks it's his, including painting the reflecting pool now, emptying it out and painting it like it's a swimming pool at one of his gaudy hotels.
Andrew, from the legal, let's go back to that. I'm not accusing you of being a constitutional scholar, although you do surprise me in just about all this stuff. If you go back to... You were the guy, I don't know if you remember saying this, when you first came on the show, you explained to us how the Supreme Court being a separate piece of government was a huge advancement from, like, the British and the other people's governments. I don't know if you remember saying that, but you did. Now, my question is, where exactly is there any sort of enforcement power? Let's say the Supreme Court tomorrow says, oh, no, Hegseth, you can't do that. You got to let the media in, and the next day you show up and they turn you around, kick you in the ass, and send you down the stairs. I mean, what can the Supreme Court do about that? Is the answer nothing?
Very little. It's based on an honor system, and if the people you're working with don't respect the honor system, then it's almost unenforceable. And so we have grown up in a world where there is an honor system and people are supposed to obey. But if people who have the actual military power, the police power, the Homeland Security power, say, well, we have a different view, then we've got to challenge ourselves and our thinking. What are we going to do about it? Are we just going to accept that or not? Now, there is a historical precedent that's worth remembering, that when Abraham Lincoln himself was confronted not with the entire Supreme Court, but with a Chief Justice ruled against him during the Civil War, Lincoln basically ignored it. He didn't make, and he was, of course, a very accomplished lawyer, but he basically made a decision that this decision by a pro-Confederate Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Roger Taney, they just weren't going to follow it. So we have that buried back in our history, and this is why the study of history is getting more popular in a way, even though people have to think about making a living with more practical studies, in a sense. But to the extent that people value a functioning government or country, it's important to know, okay, we've been through such and such a thing, and here's the reaction, and here's the instruction for what we got to do today.
It is stunning how on the show we talk about a million different subjects, but they all end up in the same place. I mean, Carl is our lead ranter and raver regarding medical costs. And the Supreme Court has said basically twice, and he can name the decisions, no, hospitals can't charge different people different amounts. And yet they do. They don't care. And we're never going to get anybody, any senator Republican who's to get their ass packet stuffed with checks from the drug companies, the hospitals, we're never going to get them to do anything about it. I mean, if the people don't act in some sort of a moral manner, is our system functionally dysfunctional? I mean, I'm almost coming to that conclusion, Andrew. I almost am, to be honest with you.
Well, it is, but let's put ourselves in the category of would-be reformers here, because we wouldn't be interested in this stuff if we weren't interested in some kind of action. And you've identified a problem that a lot of the people we expect to take action don't. It may sound like a digression, but it's at least it'll be brief. But here's why. The first thing I did this morning, waking up, was check gas prices in Mississippi and Alaska as of today.
Really?
And here's why. Last night, I had read an article that, amazingly enough, there's a chance that a Democrat might win the U.S. Senate race in Mississippi. And it was a long article. Of course, it's a long shot. But in Alaska, the Democrat is actually polling slightly ahead. And these are two extremely red states. And to get to the point here, I thought, I'll bet gas prices are going to help determine these races. What is the gas price in Alaska and Mississippi right now? Because it's probably going to stay there and go up. So, voters and the general public are motivated by many things. And for most people, it's not going to be thinking about the Supreme Court and its powers.
Right.
It's going to be much more, how do I get to work?
Well, I think we got to go to break, but we come back. There's, you know, some stuff is going on here in Chicago with the police shooting and everything. And I think, plus a lot of people, I think this Comey thing is such crap, it's unbelievable. But, let's talk about it. I think a lot of people think the entire justice system for antitrust down is free and useless. I mean, well, the guy who's the attorney general, he's Trump's personal attorney, for God's sake. I mean, where are we going with this? S&P futures up 40, NASDAQ futures up 212. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
We are going to have a Heroes for Heroes kickoff party promo. If you're looking to raise a pint and give back to the Friends of Fisher House and the Revolutionary Brewing, a Heroes kickoff party happens Friday, May 5th from 4 p.m. to close at their Kinsey Road Brewery, seeing through... swing through for food, raffle, and good company, and have a chance to learn about Fisher House and how they support the military and our veterans. For the month of May, a portion of the Revolution Brewery's sales will be donated to the Friends of Fisher House, providing a home away from home for veterans and military families. The event is free and open to anyone who is willing to support this great cause that the Heroes of Heroes kickoff party again is May 8th, starting at 4 p.m., and the brewery is at 3340 North Kinsey. Back to you, Chief.
Thank you, James. SP Futures up 35, NASDAQ Futures up 186. We'll be quick. There were a lot of earnings last night. We've got Amazon up $9. We've got Meta, which disappointed. They're down $56. That's 8%. Microsoft was down. It was way up. Then it was down, way down. And now it's only down $4. So they're almost almost steady. Google's up $26, up 7%. So I'd say most are to the upside of the big earnings places or the big companies last night. I'd say so. It was positive across the board, except for maybe Meta and Microsoft a little bit over in Europe. Real quick, the DAX up 222.9%, FTSE up 160.5%. We're not sure exactly why they're higher, because oil prices have surged, but the Bank of England and the ECB both hold rates steady, as did the Fed. Kick around up 8, call that flat. Asia, Nikkei down 632, even though these guys had a really good month. Down 632 today. Hang Seng down 335, it's 1.3%. Shanghai unchanged, which is interesting. Bonds, there's a big move up in interest rates yesterday. Today they're down a little bit, but we almost made it to 5% on the 30 and almost made it to 4.5 on the 10. So these interest rates are starting to creep up again, which is a problem for the market, at least at some point. Oil down 218, but still 104.70. We've got gold up $84. Finally, a rally in gold. That's almost 2%. Silver up $2. That's 3%. By the way, hold this thought on the oil, because Andrew was just talking about that before. Our Bob is at 370, so we're going to come back to that after we're done here. Gold up 80. Well, I said it was up $84. We get foreign exchange, same euro about 117, a pound 135, and pretty steady. Crypto up 874, 76, 324. Real quick, Jimmy, traffic, weather, sports, Cubs win.
Cubs win, Sox wins for sports. Right now on travel time, the inbound Kennedy is 38 minutes. The inbound Edens is 44. The inbound Eisenhower is at 39 degrees, and the inbound Dan Ryan is at 31. In weather, real quick, Phoenix is currently at 68 degrees with a high of 92, and it will be mostly cloudy and obviously warm. Now, here in Chicago, kind of the opposite story. We are currently at 43 degrees with a high of 49. Back to you, Chief.
Andrew, this is, well, for the Debody, as they say in the South Side. Whenever I say the South Side stuff, I know Andrew secretly goes back and gets the vernacular once in a while, even though he wasn't there that long. You know South Side slang, Andrew?
Uh, I was a little refreshed because last night I was reading about Nelson Algren, the great writer, who was at heart a South Sider, even though he lived on the North Side for much of his life. But finish your thought, please.
Well, the RBOB is up to $3.71. Now, for those that don't know, RBOB is the price of unleaded gasoline in New York Harbor. That's the one that trades. So that's basically your wholesale price. Now, it might be a little less or more some other places. Now, you see, to that, you have to add transportation, I guess some profit, and the taxes of the state. So when you look at the Mississippi or Alaska, the number you're probably looking at is, you know, three-something plus. Now, in Illinois, Indiana just dropped their sales tax on gas. J.D. Pritzker, you're never going to get a dime back from that guy. He's not doing it. Matter of fact, the sales tax, the gas tax just went up here in Illinois. So we're pushing a dollar here. Plus, they have sales tax is on the other taxes, guys, which is really, I don't know how the hell that flies through a court, but it does. So, you know, as I've mentioned 100 times, and you guys are, you know, stone cold sorry hearing about it, the biggest benefactor of inflation is the government. In the big companies, but basically the government. So you're really talking pushing 5 hours here in Illinois is where this is going to go. There's no way you can't, because you're talking 92 cents tax plus a little something for the guy who's shipping it and selling it to you. So we're pushing 5 hours here easy. So when you, if you look at Mississippi and it's you know, 4:30, it probably means the Mississippi gas tax is less than here, even though the federal taxes are all the same, and maybe they don't have sales tax on gas or not on the taxes. So when you look at that, you sort of got to be careful. But you know what's weird, guys, is you just did it and I just did it. When you look at what you're putting in the tank, even though it affects you, the wise American now should look over his shoulder and look at the price of diesel, because that's more important, and diesel is way up. Home heating oil is $4.14 $4.15 a gallon before the taxes. So diesel affects you more than your own gas unless you're a traveling salesman. Am I correct on that or no?
Yeah, because, of course, connect the dots, but you've talked about it before. Diesel is what truckers and farmers and others use, and it's a more complicated refining process. And ultimately, we pay for the increased costs of farming and trucking.
Plus, we're selling it overseas, right?
Yeah. Just to mention specifically Mississippi, the figures I looked up range from $3.71 to $4.14 in Mississippi. Of course, the standard of living is lower there. In Alaska, you're looking at the high end of like $4.85 per gallon. This is for regular, and you know, they're driving big distances up there in Alaska. They're used to paying more than we are down here, but again, you have a lot of people who are living on, I wouldn't say marginal, but you got, it's you don't have a lot of hedge fund bonuses coming in up there to cushion the blow.
I guess both of you guys, I'd like your opinion on this. Is we've talked. I don't know, you guys, I know are busy enough. We don't get a chance to listen to some of the other shows, but we've been driving this because our friend Hal has done all this work, and I think I mentioned to you guys last week regarding the combination of the banking laws and the money supply growth and the inflation growth, and he's drawn this correlation between the amount of money that's being pushed into the system, the inflation it's causing, and he's combining it with who gets to access the liquidity that comes in. And in some ways, he thinks it's way worse than it was during the 70s because it's much more selective who gets to access the money because of the banking laws. And I used the example the other day that if, you know, Wayne ever lets a moth out of that wallet and decides to buy 1,000 shares of IBM at PTI, trading 226, he only has to send us a check for 113, which I know is chump change for Wayne, but he gets to borrow the other half sight unseen, as long as we don't find his name on an Interpol thing.
And
you know, we have to do an investigation, but really, as long as Wayne is an upright individual of any sort, our RBC or IB is going to give him $115 check or loan today. And this is what Hal found, in that tells the term, Andrew, or Wayne, that's non-something-something financial institutions are getting all this credit, meaning the stock market and the bond market and those kinds of things. They're the ones that are getting all this spare cash. Where if the three of us plunked down the same $115,000 out of Wayne's wallet and bought a house cash, say, that needed remodeling, and the three of us trundle over to the bank and want a $100,000 loan to fix the house up where we know we can sell it at $400,000, the bank's going to kick our ass out the door. The ease of accessing, I never, all my years of monetary policy, I never thought of it that way until Hal brought that up. What do you guys think of that?
Well, it's complicated, and I have listened to you guys talk about it, and in a very informed way, and I'm trying to get my hands around it. It sounds logical. It sounds like a problem. Let me illustrate with a maybe related problem that I witnessed firsthand involving a Chicago banker. And so I was covering the trial of Paul Manafort, who at one point was the campaign manager for President Trump's 2016 election. And as part of the trial, the government brought out all of these loans that he was getting, both from Russian oligarchs for his work over there to help them in Ukraine and elsewhere, but also from a Chicago banker. And I, being from Chicago, and the fact that it was just extraordinary, the money that this Chicago banker was sending to Manafort, you know, a political operative, I mean, millions of dollars. And it was so extraordinary that I thought surely there were going to be repercussions for the banker, but nothing actually happened, even though it was kind of written off in a way, and the banker put in on his list of the jobs that he wanted in the administration, secretary of the army and all kinds of other things, deputy secretary of state, things at that level. And I thought, this is just, you couldn't make this up, but it actually happened, and nothing, there seemed to be no consequences.
Well, do you remember the bank?
I can, not off the top of my head, I'll send it to you. But I thought, aren't there depositors for this bank? Isn't there a board of directors? Isn't there a Justice Department? I mean, what?
Wayne, I'm going to ask Andrew a very, actually to both of you guys, more Andrew because he's an attorney. When you look back at this history of this stuff, and, you know, if you're a conspiracy theorist, I mean, my brother and I have this discussion all the time. You know, of course, you have a brother, you're supposed to argue with him all the time, right, even if he's the best guy on earth. Dan is still of the opinion, maybe he's nicer than me, that all these, I'll use the term, policy screw-ups, how's that for a term, over the last, you know, 40 years that we've been watching the world, are all just good people doing the right thing, just making a mistake. or not having the right information or something like that. And I've gone, I don't know, maybe because I talk to guys like you, I don't know, I've gone exactly the opposite on that. When every single time this random decision comes down, that all of a sudden the same people are the winners and the same people are the losers. If I see this happening again and again, I start to think that maybe this game is rigged. You know, like the roulette table in Casablanca, right? You know, I have not seen, you just mentioned something. Why is there somewhere in our, and we've talked about it the whole show today, kind of nipped around the edges. Why are there never any repercussions for anybody that does this really horrible stuff? I mean, if you read, Andrew and Wayne, you guys probably don't, remember the thing that the British government finally, whenever they do something, you know, when they go to war or something, like a year or two later, they write up a report. Somebody does. I don't know who the somebody is. I don't know how, you know. But they wrote up a report about the Second Iraq War. And it was scathing, not only for their guys, but clearly for our guys. Every time they tried to get Rumsfeld and Cheney and those guys to focus in on what was Iraq going to look like after we knocked Osama out of there, he said all they were doing was talking about who was going to get the oil. That's all they cared about. Okay, so now how many people got killed over there? We still listen to Diane talk about people in the veterans' homes and people that are, you know, minus arms and legs and stuff. Why? There was never any review on this end. Nobody ever got hung. Nobody even got chastised. Nobody even got a bad reputation. I mean, and the first war, you got poor Colin Powell talking about weapons of mass destruction. That war cost us $1.5 trillion plus how many arms and legs? I still people see running on the beach, on the path with the metal thing where a leg used to be. None of those people. There never were any weapons of mass. How was now this thing? There was never a plutonium big bomb in Iran. There never was. I mean, they're you know, there's not good people, but how is it there's never any at any level? There's never any repercussions for any of these people. I mean, and yet, Andrew, you're still a believer in the system. I guess I sort of am. I think Wayne is. Why are we believers? It's right in our face. It doesn't work. It doesn't appear.
Well, to answer your question about the difference between the UK and here, the British Parliament has the ability to establish investigative committees, which they did in Iraq and with other scandals, and they're not as this is where you have your permanent civil service. The thing, we had one of those until Elon Musk and Trump destroyed it. But the permanent civil service, you got ministers coming and going, but that that cabinet secretary, cabinet level secretary, and that's where we get the term permanent committee on such and such. Everything over there, you've got a permanent parliamentary official, a permanent cabinet official, and that's why you get those reports that are not influenced. Well, they're influenced somewhat, but they're more independent than what you see come out of this our Congress, for example. We did have an independent inspector general force. Trump has completely emaciated that. So we don't really have the machinery in our government right now to do independent oversight. We saw it yesterday with Congress. But remember, the Democrats are in a minority. You always got that Republican chairman basically. he's pushing the envelope for his side. And cutting off the Democrats, and I think that's why, here in Florida they're going to get rid of a whole bunch of other gerrymandered seats to favor the Republicans, but I have a feeling that Florida is going to go Democratic, and I think the Senate seat is in play here, so we could see. If it's a free and fair election, that is, and that's my biggest problem right now is how we may not have that type of election this year.
Well, if you were to the MAGA people, if you ask them about the UK right now, they're all a bunch of assholes. They don't follow Trump. If you read that report and how we basically hornswoggled them the first time, they basically said in that report they're never going to follow us down one of these rat holes again, and they're not.
No. No, and not only them, but you know, you look at Canada and Australia. We're basically in the world of diplomacy right now. We're a pariah. Trump thinks his best friends are Kim Jong Un, Vladimir Putin, Xi in China. Even though you know we've got economic issues with them, and this guy Lukashenko in Belarus. This is why you've got Maduro's vice president now is Trump's best friend in Venezuela. He doesn't care about democracy. He cares about, you know, basically doing deals with dictators.
Well, don't forget the Middle East. There's some friends over there.
yeah.
guys, I'm going to turn the page here a little bit. Paul Harvey, page 2. GDP numbers came out. First quarter, 2% growth. Now, you know, I explain this every time this comes out. The PCE index, or actually the deflator, which they don't, it's probably the same thing, is for the month is 0.7%. All right. So, what that means is, say for the first quarter, they got a year over year. Let's say it's 1.3% for the quarter. What that means is that the actual GDP, the gross number, is 3.1%, of which 1.1% of that is inflation, which gets you down to the 2. So if the inflation, if, in other words, if the GDP growth for the year is 10% and inflation is 10%, your net is 0. I hope everybody understands that. So when they're saying this now, they're saying the net GDP growth is at a 2% annual rate, and that the PCE year over year is essentially, well, actually they're saying the PCE year over year, or that's for the, let's say for the month, is 0.7%, all right, on a yearly basis. Actually, no, that's on a monthly basis. So what they're really saying is, now if that's 2.1 for the quarter, which is high, by the way, is that we're actually talking at a gross number is 4.1. I don't think there's any growth, guys. I don't think there's been any real growth for pushing 20 years. You know, if you actually look at inflation adjusted, if you take the, and I'll be specific on this, if you were to go back to, let's say, 2007, maybe even 2000, and raise the healthcare piece of the basket from 6% to 20%, which it is of the economy, and go back and recalculate, it would probably add 0.7-0.8% to the inflation the whole way. And I don't think, if you added that to the deflator, I think in virtually all those years were either even or down. And if you take the ridiculous way they look at the home owner's equivalent rent, you add that to it, and put in stuff like taxes, I think the average American has been in a recession for 20, at least, maybe 27 years. What do you guys think of that? I'll just lob that out there.
Well, you're analyzing the figures in a very granular way, and I defer to you on that. But big picture, let's just think of the sectors that we started a year ago talking about the tariffs and how difficult it would be for a business to make new investments with the kaleidoscope of differing tariffs and whether they would be upheld. And then you start looking at sectors like farming or transportation, but construction. How could people make midterm investments that boost the economy in these sectors? It's very difficult. So I think a kind of big picture gut check matches your detailed figures.
What I would add here in Florida, we have so many abandoned construction projects here. Now, this started under DeSantis before Trump came in for his second term, but I've got one in the street right next to where I live. It's like they built these stairwells for a huge condominium complex. Well, the only thing there are these stairwells that go up about three or four stories, and I call it like it's our version of Stonehenge, just sitting there in a rather haphazard pattern. But this is an issue here in Florida, and I we've got now for the first time ever gas over $4 a gallon. That's never been the case here, $4.19, and people are, all these Trumpers where I live are no longer happy about them. Now the issue is, will they turn out to vote? But even if they don't turn out to vote, I think that may be an indication.
Wait, do you have any idea what the tax is there? It seems low. Do you guys have a refinery? You must have a refinery near you.
Yeah, there are refineries. Well, I think we've got one in Tampa here, and up in the Jacksonville area as well.
Hey, by the way, if you take this PCE index for the month, 0.7, and multiply it by 12, you're talking 8.4%. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, well, guys, what do you think of Powell sticking around? How is it that the entire group there, for the whole entire time that guy's been in, you know, I love the guy as a, because he has some backbone, I think. But he's done everything that Trump wanted him to do, yet Trump still does nothing but insult him. I think he's been, he could be the one of the, he's being pushed by somebody, in my idea of a Fed chairman. All he's done is raise the money supply whenever they want him to do it. He hasn't done anything that I would want him to do the whole time he's been there. Yet now he's not quitting, which I actually agree with. But what do you make of that? What's your view?
Well, you raised that on, I think, yesterday's show. I think the answer simply is he's worried that he'll be prosecuted like Comey as soon as he quits. That's one factor. He probably also, since he doesn't have to quit, let me give him some credit that maybe he wants to watch out for the good of the economy by his lights and stick around rather than retire and be out of power. So, you know, the joke is that everybody wants to relax on a beach if they make it, but some people would like to keep working. So I think there's two factors to answer your question why he's sticking around. And that leads briefly, because I know we're out of time, to the Comey indictment. But we've mentioned it throughout the show, but your busy listeners may not know what it's about. He took a picture of somebody who had arranged seashells on a beach, and it used a kind of slogan in the restaurant industry, 86, which means get them out of here.
It doesn't mean kill him. It means take him.
And he took a picture of it and put it up on the internet of 8647, and he's under indictment. I don't have the precise charge in mind, but it's basically conspiracy to
kill the president.
Assassinate the president.
Yeah.
For taking a picture of something that somebody else had done. And there will be no trial, and if there ever is a trial, it's a guaranteed acquittal. But what it does is it sends a message to all the fraidy cats in government or anywhere else that if we can do this to a University of Chicago 1985 law school graduate, James Comey, who went on to become FBI director, we can do it to you, whatever part of the bureaucracy or private sector job you have. So be afraid of the almighty Trump.
What how many people,
that's the story.
Andrew, how many people do you think this president had their sole job following Comey everywhere he went, every time he went to the can looking for something? Sort of like Elliot Spitzer-esque, right?
Oh, lots. And one of the columnists I follow and who gets all the transcripts and does in-depth analysis wrote yesterday that what they did was use the bogus investigation in Virginia, an indictment of Comey that was thrown out, as an excuse to ramp up further their investigation of everything about him that leads to this next bogus indictment. And again, the message is to everyone in the United States, Trump is all powerful. Be aware of any criticism or doing anything, even taking a picture of seashells on the beach.
Well, you know, Andrew, we started a couple minutes late, so let's run. This is a kind of an important thing I'm going to get out. You guys are my conscience in some of this stuff. I had a friend, because he passed away a lot older. Mike Tooman was a judge, right? And we still, once in a while, on Wednesday night, gather and have a Tooman night for all his old friends. Mike was this guy that was, a renowned judge in Chicago. He had a couple of appeals court decisions, which still, I think, stand to this day. One of them was, Andrew, you're probably interested in this. There was a guy who rigged the jury, and they brought him up on trial again, and the argument was that was double indemnity. So Mike's opinion, very well thought out, very well written, was that because he rigged the jury, he was never under indemnity the first time. So that doesn't apply to him. Because it was rigged, he never was at risk. And I think that's pretty much stood to this day. But anyway, Mike was the judge that sent Jeff Fort to jail and other places where he, whenever there was a case like that, they'd tap him because he's this little Irish guy, a former Marine, was absolutely fearless. And they wanted to put machine gun nests in front of his house during that trial, and he wouldn't let them do it. He goes, no, one squad's plenty. I don't want that on my block. But the funny part is, Mike also was not married. His nephew and niece lived in California. I wonder, and as tough and as nice as Mike was, and as ramrod Irish straight he was, if he'd had a family walking off to school during the day, if he could have done that. I mean, I think Comey's, my read of him, I know a couple of the guys I'm telling you I meet with, knew Comey because they were in the FBI. They said he was so straight to the point he was so boring they didn't want to hang around with him. He said he was absolutely so straight and so dedicated. Now, the question is, if it's just Comey, I think he fights without gloves. But what if he's got 5 kids and 10 grandkids, knowing that the morons that are out there that are looking like this? I mean, we've got a guy at Trump who's after him. And he's after Comey for threatening the president. Did you listen to that interview last week with what's her name, Norah O'Donnell? How many times did he call her a despicable person?
Marine Comey, Comey's daughter, was the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York, Brooklyn, who brought the successful indictment and conviction of Ghislaine Maxwell. She was fired by the Trump Justice Department. And the day before the indictment of Comey for the Seychelles incident, she successfully argued that her case against the government, the judge said it can go on. The lawsuit can go on with discovery and everything else involved. I think those two things are connected as well.
Without a doubt. What are the chances of Todd Blanche rolling over tomorrow morning and saying he's going to fix some of this? I mean, what a joke.
Well, it's not just that he's former personal attorney of Trump, but much more important is every one of his major actions has been as if he's that's not in the past, that he's a devoted lackey and yes man. So, you know, we like to look at past connections as indicators, but sometimes people go beyond their past connections. But in this case, he's acting like this is an apprenticeship to get in, I'll just say it, I can't prove it, internal motivations. But if people are making absolute fortunes, he's positioning himself to get in with the big boys after this is over.
So, all right, we got a dash, guys. Good stuff. We'll talk to you next week, if not sooner. When do I have to hustle and get my passport renewed now to not get this guy's picture in it?
Well, everyone is right now who has an imminent expiration date.
Oh,
well, let me take 20 more seconds Please. To tee up something. Much more dangerous is the concept that there's an important movement to prove that you're a citizen to vote.
Yeah.
And there's only two basic ways to do it, to have a current passport or an original or close to an original birth certificate. And a lot of people don't have either. And so we can joke about the picture, and that is offensive to me at least, so we make a joke of it. But a serious thing, suppose you want to vote and you're a married woman and the name on your birth certificate, if you have it, is different. So
what, only 50% of the people have passports, right? Is it even that high?
Oh, it's less than that.
Yeah.
By a lot, I think.
Less in the red states, though, than in the blue areas of the country, interestingly enough.
And you can't prove citizenship except in four states with a driver's license. So we think, oh, yeah, we're a citizen. None of this affects us. Well, how about in a couple of years?
Hey, Andrew, I got a question. You guys are – it's been so long since I had my first passport. What did I have to show to get it for the first one? I don't even remember.
I think your previous passport is sufficient.
Well, I mean, my first one. I first went to Europe, and I didn't go as
long. Yeah, any previous passport – expired.
I know. I'm saying, but
ask you to send that in your application.
No, my question is, if I didn't have one,
oh,
what do I have to show up? I don't even remember.
You have to show up a state issued birth certificate.
They've probably tightened up the requirements. I don't know the answer.
I don't,
your question.
I think I'd have remembered. I think I'd have remembered having to get a birth certificate. I think my driver's license was good enough for
you. Yeah, you'd have to get that from Springfield if you don't have it.
Actually, you go to the county building here and get it. But I mean, I think it was like a driver's license and a utility bill. I don't think it was a utility bill. I don't remember bringing my birth certificate. Maybe I did. It was 40 years ago. Anyway, guys, thank you very much. SP Futures up 40. NASDAQ Futures up 204. We seem to like the earnings from yesterday. Again, Meta's the one down 54. Google up 23. Microsoft, kind of a dud, down 5. Amazon's up 9. So I'd say that mostly to the positive there in the big guys. We still have NVIDIA to go. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.